Caitlin Clark's remarks at WNBA All-Star Weekend in Chicago were measured and specific. She said she objects to a false characterization of who she is by media, and she said this after weeks of controversy involving on-court incidents and what she described as racially charged commentary. Clark is in a genuinely difficult position. She's the most visible player the WNBA has ever had. Attendance records, viewership records, merchandise sales that changed the financial model of the league. And the conversation around her involves race, class, and the economics of women's sports in ways that are complicated and often reductive in both directions. Her choice to address it directly rather than deflect is notable.
What strikes me about the Clark situation is how much of the media environment around her has been driven by people who are not primarily basketball writers. It's become a culture war proxy, with people who couldn't name five other WNBA players opining passionately about her treatment. Clark herself clearly wants to play basketball. The incidents on the court that sparked some of the recent controversy look, to anyone watching the games closely, like the normal physicality of professional basketball rather than targeted harassment. But that analysis gets drowned out by commentary that's not really about basketball.
Messi's third consecutive absence from the MLS All-Star Game is becoming an interesting story in its own right. He joined Inter Miami in 2023. He has never appeared in this mid-season showcase. This year, the reason is rest after Argentina's World Cup run, which is entirely legitimate. But MLS sold its All-Star event in part on the promise of Messi as a marquee attraction. 3 years in, that promise has not been delivered in this specific context, and the league has had to build its all-star product around other names.
The Netflix prediction market's documentary debuting, despite Kalshi's cease and desist, is a small story with interesting implications. Kalshi, the prediction market platform, sent a cease and desist trying to stop a documentary that apparently examines prediction markets in ways Kalshi found unflattering. The documentary went ahead anyway, which suggests Netflix's legal team concluded the First Amendment protections for documentary journalism were robust. The irony of a company whose entire business model is about free market information flows, trying to suppress information about itself, is fairly pointed.
Katy Perry going after the White House for using firework in a TikTok celebrating Iran strikes is part of a longer story about political campaigns and administrations using pop songs without licensing or ideological alignment. Perry's statement that her music is for bringing people together, not celebrating warfare, is worth taking at face value. Firework is literally a song about resilience and self-expression. The choice of it for a military strike video suggests whoever made that editorial decision was operating purely on vibe and not thinking about the artist's stated intent or the licensing implications.
The fired 60 Minutes correspondent detailing CBS bias claims is a media story that touches on something real about the pressures commercial television journalism operates under. Without knowing all the specifics of the correspondent's claims, the pattern they're describing, editorial decisions shaped by corporate relationships, advertiser sensitivities, and access journalism concerns, is well documented in media criticism and largely unremarkable as a structural description of commercial TV news. Whether the specific claims rise to actionable bias or just reflect normal editorial judgment is the contested question.
Now, I want to spend the back half of this segment on a genuine analytical challenge, because I think there's a confident claim floating around about how the Iran conflict resolves, and I want to stress test it. The dominant assumption in most of the analysis I'm reading is that the Oman-brokered talks will produce some form of face-saving de-escalation, a pause that becomes a ceasefire, that becomes a framework agreement, with both sides claiming enough to justify stopping. The logic is, the U.S. can't sustain the munitions expenditure indefinitely, Iran can't sustain the economic damage indefinitely, and Oman has successfully brokered similar arrangements before. So what if that's wrong?
The strongest counter-argument starts with Iran's domestic politics. Pezeshkian's disclosure about Khamenei's private authorization of talks, if that goes viral inside Iran, could make any negotiated agreement politically toxic for the Iranian government before it even reaches a final form. The hardline factions within Iran's Revolutionary Guard and in parliament have every incentive to characterize a negotiated pause as capitulation. Khamenei is dead. The new supreme leadership is not yet consolidated. A peace deal signed right now could be the thing that destabilizes Pezeshkian's government from within, which would mean the U.S. would have a deal with a government that then collapses.
And on the American side, the confidence in Oman as a reliable broker rests on a specific assumption, that what Oman conveys from Tehran is what Tehran actually intends. There are historical cases where back-channel communications carried messages that turned out to represent one Iranian faction's position, but not the overall government's. If the Revolutionary Guard and Pezeshkian's team are not actually coordinating on the talks, what Oman thinks it's brokering may not be enforceable on Iran's side.
There's also a third-party spoiler problem. If Netanyahu's visit to Trump on Tuesday produces an agreement to continue strikes regardless of the Oman talks, and Israel has its own interests in whether a functional Iranian state emerges from this, then the diplomatic track can be undermined by action without any party to the Oman talks formally breaking it. The U.S. and Iran could be negotiating in good faith while Israeli operations complicate the ground situation.
What would we watch for as evidence that the confident de-escalation scenario is actually going wrong? I'd watch three things. First, whether the Revolutionary Guard makes any public statement about the Oman talks in the next 10 days. Their silence is a sign the talks have at least tacit hardliner tolerance. A statement denouncing negotiations as unauthorized would be a significant warning sign. Second, whether U.S. munitions replenishment orders show up in defense procurement announcements, which would suggest the military is planning for continued strikes rather than a wind down. Third, what Netanyahu and Trump actually say to cameras after Tuesday's meeting, not what the readout says, but the specific language around all options.
And I'd add one more. Watch the Hormuz traffic data. Shipping intelligence firms track vessel movements through the strait in near real time. If commercial traffic starts flowing more normally before any public announcement of a deal, it means something is happening diplomatically that's producing real confidence on the ground. If it stays disrupted after the talks are announced as advancing, the markets know something the press releases don't.